Hey, Lauren, I don't know if you know this, but I'm like really kind of hip and I know what's like cool out
there. You're with it?
I'm kind of with it. So I recently found this trend, which I guess is probably over a year or two old, so it's not that cool now. But I wanted to share it with you. Have you seen this thing that's around the internet of cats in space on food?
It's incredible.
Yeah. So I got this calendar here. I'm holding it up so you can look at it. This is the calendar I got from my Secret Santa this year of cats in space on various food items such as pizza, hot dogs, hamburgers.
A moon made of cheese.
Which that's
we
right.
could have anticipated.
My question is this a thing or is this not a thing?
Well, I think it's no longer a thing now that you know about it, but I think it was definitely a thing probably in 2016.
Is that how old it is?
Yeah.
I just recently found it.
But it's all over the internet.
I'm not sure if I like it or not. That's the thing. Is it cool?
Well, I think that it's just inexplicable. It's just weird. It's three things you would never put together, and yet here they are. All are just like a skyline cheese coney.
I mean, I'm actually kind of like impressed. That's actually a good analogy. In fact, I think there's a cat on a coney too, by the way.
I'm already hungry.
I mean, it does incorporate three things I do like.
Yeah.
Cats, space, and food. And yeah. I just think it's like, so if you really want to have some fun and go out there and search the internet, just do a Google search cats in space on food.
And you can find, you know, a cat planting the flag on that cheese moon with a cheese pizza.
Yeah, and a lot of them shoot laser beams out of their eyes, too. I like that part. I think that's kind of cool.
Well, cats, we don't know what cats do when we're not around. So for all we know, this has been going on for centuries.
Wait a second. Maybe these aren't Photoshopped. Maybe you know something, Worley. Have you been up and you've had NASA secrets?
I can't confirm or deny the existence of space cat aliens with food on other planets.
There you have it, people. She said it. There's a denial. I think we've been to space. The cats have been to space. From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
And I'm Lauren Worley, sitting in for the unstoppable Anna Heyman. I'm the former NASA press secretary and now the chief communications and engagement officer for Cincinnati Public Schools. Dean's the astronomer from the Cincinnati Observatory and co-host of PBS's Stargazers. In this episode, we're talking with Dr. Jillian Scudder, assistant professor at Oberlin University and author of the book Astroquizzical, A Curious Journey Through Our Cosmic Family Tree.
Well, we're already into 2019, and we're looking forward to a lot of great space stories. I know I have some of my favorite things that we're going to be looking forward to, but I always like to kind of recap the year, too. And so I wanted to see, Lauren, what you thought were, like, your favorite stories from 2018. Like, what things kind of, like, captured your attention and maybe you think captured the public at large?
Absolutely. Well, I think the first one was the announcement of the astronauts who are going to test the next American spacecraft going to space. It was kind of if you live in the space world, you would have heard about it, but I don't know that everybody did. And, you know, they've selected some very experienced astronauts and some that have only done one or two missions to the space station. And these are the folks that are going to test the Boeing spacecraft and the SpaceX spacecraft that will take humans back to space launching from U.S. soil.
So not just like NASA rockets. These are like the private enterprises too.
Absolutely. And you know, this is what follows on to the space shuttle program. And really, it's not been since the late 70s, early 80s since we've tested a spacecraft with humans like this. So this is a generational thing that's about to happen here. It's really exciting.
Cool. That is pretty cool.
Yeah.
What did you think of the Mars lander, you know, the Mars InSight lander that happened in 2018?
It was so exciting because, you know, we learn a lot about our own planet by studying Mars. We don't know why Mars no longer has an atmosphere, an atmosphere like Earth's, mm-hmm. and so we need to study that and understand it, understand what's happened on that planet. Could be a telltale sign for things that could happen to the Earth, or better help us better understand where we came from.
Yeah, and I always love watching the NASA scientists when, like, they land stuff places. They get so excited. They're like, you know, like, it's like their Super Bowl. When, like,
well,
this
and
thing
they have years
down.
To plan for this, too. So this isn't, you know, unlike the Super Bowl where you have, you know, kind of months to plan, you've got years to plan for a mission. So whether it's a fancy haircut or a handshake, you've got lots of time to plan for what your reaction might be.
Yeah. Oh,
presuming a good outcome.
Oh, so these aren't spontaneous like cheers and
take away the mystique?
Mohawks and various other things that they're always.
You would have time to grow a mohawk in time for the James Webb Space Telescope launch, I think.
You do got to plan ahead, don't you, for that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
So what else did you see from 2018 that grabbed you?
Well, there were some missions that ended and there was new ones that started. So Kepler, which was an incredible mission, discovered nearly 3,000 exoplanets. And if you're not familiar with exoplanets, those are planets that exist outside our solar system. What that revealed to us is that our solar system isn't the only home for planets, and this is a big part of the search for life outside of our solar system. It was also the end of the Dawn mission, which really helped us understand two of the largest objects in our solar system, Vesta and Sirius, which are dwarf planets.
Those asteroids between Mars and Jupiter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that mission, went to both of them. So, it flew by Vesta first, and then they went around Vesta.
That's
orbiting.
Not the way I would go. I would have done Sirius first and then Vesta, but what do I know?
I know. You go bigger to smaller. They went to smaller, and they left the biggest for last.
Yeah, well.
But think, that's, such a cool engineering feat. They've launched from Earth to Vesta, circle around Vesta for a few months, then move on to the next one. I mean, this is not, easy. This is not,
It's the first spacecraft to orbit two deep space destination.
Yeah, yeah. So. Oh, man, that's right. So those are two, Kepler and Dawn,
So we learned a lot, but, so many of these missions, like the Mars rovers, Opportunity and Spirit, those were built for about 100-day missions and last for almost a decade. So these missions often last longer than they're initially designed for, but it's still really bittersweet when they end.
Well, so for 2019, I'm going to try to make my predictions.
What do you got in store for us?
What are going to be the biggest stories of the year astronomically? I mean, I think it's hard to say exactly, but number one seems like a slam dunk. It's the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing is this summer. So July 20th, all the astronauts are going to be out making the circuits and talking about this. And I think people of certain ages, older people than us, of course, remember what it was like when the moon landing happened. And I think this is going to be one of those things where people are going to really remember this anniversary.
I was at NASA during the 45th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing and had the opportunity to meet Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins, who stayed back in the limb and orbited the moon while Buzz and Neil Armstrong were down on the moon's surface.
Oh, cool.
And escorted them to the Oval Office where they got to meet President Obama. But
wait, did you get to go to the Oval Office too?
Not on that trip, no.
No, but you have been and met President Obama?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. That's another podcast. But Michael Collins, the guy who stayed back, is incredibly inspiring to me because there's one type of person who you would expect to be brave enough to walk on the moon's surface and to be the first people or group of people to do that. But then to be the person that gets all the way there and then to hang back. To maybe have to abort the mission and leave them there if needed. It's just an incredible American hero. They're just inspiring. It'll be great to see them celebrate that 50th anniversary milestone this year.
Well, now I know another thing that's going to happen this year is you're going to get me into the Oval Office this year. That's going to be another space story. I don't know if you still have those connections, but
not really. But we'll do what we can for
all
you,
right.
Dean. For you.
Now the other story is going to be. I don't know about this one. This one is exciting to me, but this could be a little too nerdy.
Even for the Looking Up podcast.
Maybe even for me. but for me, this is what I'm looking for, is November 11th, the planet Mercury is going in front of the sun. It's called a transit of Mercury. It's a rare thing. It's like a little teeny tiny mini eclipse. And the last one we had was in 2016, but it was so cloudy all around the United States. Almost all the United States was clouded out. And so this one is the last one visible from the U.S. until 2049.
Wow.
And so I'm super psyched about it. This is one of the astronomical things that I have never seen. I've seen all sorts of eclipses. I've seen transit of Venus. I've seen auroras. I've seen all this stuff, but I've never seen a transit of Mercury.
Do you have a literal bucket list? Like if you could just make a checklist that we could be like, checks all the Venus transit, checks all the solar eclipse.
Exactly. I do. I have a whole list. I have all of my eclipses mapped out for the next the rest of my lifetime. I do plan on living at least till the year 2061 to see Halley's Comet back.
I can't miss that.
So, yeah, I mean, everybody's got that on their list, I'm sure.
I'm going to go home and buy some multivitamins today just so I can make it that long.
Yeah, and then there's, well, then there's 2045 is the solar eclipse. That'll be from my nursing home in Florida. So I got that already plot out. Mm-hmm. Me and James Albury from Stargazers are going to get in our same nursing home in 2045.
You've gone ahead and put your Airbnb reservations in.
Yeah, but then I still need to live 16 more years for Halley's Comet. So this is, man, I got my work cut out for me.
Well, luckily we're living longer these days, and hopefully some of these space technologies developed for long-term space flight will inform longevity of life here on Earth.
Yeah.
That could be in store for 2019, too. I don't know.
That's true. But, well, back to the transit of Mercury. we're going to try to get people, as many people as we can, to see this. It's a Monday, and it's during the daytime, because what you're going to have to do is see this in front of the sun. Mm-hmm. And so you have to take all your special precautions. And so we're going to try to get some information out to people about how you can see it safely. So you need to protect your eyes and you need to magnify it a little bit, because Mercury is so tiny and so far away from us that it just looks like a little blemish. It looks like a little
floater.
It is. It's what it looks like going across the sun. So those are my two big stories I'm looking for. But I'm hoping the transit of Mercury when we have a clear skies, because if I miss this one, oh man, I'm not going to wait 30 more years. Well, okay, I will. Yeah, we'll put it on the list.
Yeah, you will.
All right, we'll do that. So I recently met Dr. Jillian Scudder at the Buckeye Book Fair, where we were both selling and signing our spacey books, and I found her book, Astroquizzical. It's a unique look at our solar system and is based on lots of questions from her readers of her blog. So Jillian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So we're going to get into your book, but I wanted to ask about your blog that kind of got this all started. So you had this kind of thing out there where people would ask you questions. And so what were some of like the spaciest questions, the ones that really like stick out in your mind that you received?
Let me see. There's a lot that are sort of along the same theme. And so I get a lot of questions about things about the moon, which I completely understand, because it's the easiest possible thing to start thinking about for space.
Yeah, like, we've been there.
And so people are sort of curious about the moon in general. The ones that are the most fun and stick out the most in terms of most unique are often the hypotheticals or the ones that come in from the parents with some children.
Oh, yeah.
So like, what would they ask? Like,
well, so the one that I remember the most fondly is this one that came in from the parent of a five-year-old, and this five-year-old had come up with their own cosmology of what the shape of the universe should be, and this dad was having trouble coming up with explanations that would dissuade this child from their favorite shape of the universe, which turned out to be tiger-shaped and surrounded by dinosaur bones, which is my all-time favorite mental image.
No kidding. That's the kind of divergent thinking that gets you to the moon.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Sign them up. And so you answered in the most polite fashion, how?
Well, I answered with, you know, well, we have no evidence that our universe is tiger-shaped, and here's how we know why we're sort of in a universe that is in the shape that it is, which is, as far as we can tell, infinite in all directions. And that, you know, it's a really cool idea, and that they should definitely keep writing down the ideas that this kid has, because that sounds amazing.
No doubt. Tiger-shaped.
All right, I'm on board. I'm on board.
Yeah.
No kidding. So, well, kind of with our own kind of questions like that, you talk in the book about growing life on another planet. And, you know, we often think of finding aliens or little green men or something like that. That's probably not the form life would take on. So how would we grow life on another planet?
So we're thinking about sort of the requirements that you need for life to exist. So as far as we can tell, we have a sample size of one right now of our own planet. And as far as we can tell on Earth, the main requirements are it needs to be liquid water and chemically interesting. And after that, you can make stuff happen.
Wow, we're interesting, huh?
Yeah.
That's a plus. Yeah. I like
that. Put that in my LinkedIn bio or something, you know, chemically interesting.
I have water and chemically interesting. Okay. All right. What else we need?
By the time you get to those two things, you've done most of the hard work, and then you need time after that. Mm. So, because just getting yourself to a place where you have stable liquid water is not straightforward in our universe, as far as we can tell. So we've now got suspicions that you can get liquid water on the moons of gas giant planets. So Enceladus and Europa are looking kind of exciting. And that should be stable water. But if you're looking for a planet like the Earth to have stable water, it really can only exist in a narrow range of distances from its own sun. So you have to get really lucky with planet placement just to have the liquid water present and stable on that planet.
Well, and we have some pretty exotic examples of life on Earth that are, you know, extremophiles, where they live in really weird climates. And is that something that can maybe point to some finds we might find in other worlds?
Yeah, I mean, because you don't have to be photosynthetic or anything. You can wind up with life in caves. And so winding up with a secluded, like underground kind of life process is still, that's valid. So we don't want to rule too many things out because they don't appear to work that way on Earth, because if you start looking hard enough on Earth, it seems like, there was life there too. And my favorite is extremophiles are one of these ones that live in caves. The snotites are just one of my favorite living beings of all time.
What are they like?
They're bacterial gnats. They hang off of the surface of a cave, I can't remember where, and they drip battery acid as a byproduct of their chemical reaction that they use to survive.
So it's a cave like my grandpa's garage.
Yeah. Battery acid is all over the place.
Yeah, battery acid.
Yeah, I guess that's something. They save all the batteries. Yeah.
So I want to take the topic just a little bit to galaxies.
Sure.
So,
my favorite.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And ours too. And so, Dee and I were checking out your book, and one of the things that certainly questioned me, I'm not going to question the astronomers' knowledge on all this, but, you know, we live in the Milky Way galaxy. So how do we know what the galaxy looks like? Like, how do we know it's not tiger-shaped? How do we know that it, you know, based on what we've been able to ascertain, like, how do we know what our galaxy looks like?
It's really, really hard. Basically, we have taken a lot of time to map out very precisely the locations of all the stars that we can see and their velocities, which tells us not just their location, but how fast they're moving and what their orbits should be.
We don't have a giant selfie stick, is what you're telling me.
We're trying our best to map everything else that's around us without being able to get outside of our galaxy and really map it very well. So we can't actually see the other side of the galaxy past the center. But we sort of extrapolate, well, there's a spiral arm here, and then there's another spiral arm over there, so probably those are connected. But it took us a shockingly long time to figure out that we even had a bar at the center of our galaxy. So I'm imagining that our map of the Milky Way will get revised again with Gaia, with all the new data coming out of that satellite. But it's a long and tedious process to try and map out our own galaxy.
Wow. So it's what we think we know, but we aren't even sure. That's interesting.
Could it be different? Could our idea of it be different in 5 or 10 years?
It'll probably change a little. I don't know that it'll change a ton.
Wait for because the tiger. You're going to see the tiger. Just you wait.
Although if you wait long enough, then you get a lot of changes happening as we collide with Andromeda.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We were talking about that when I met you at the Buckeye Book Fair about Andromeda. And I detected you were actually maybe like excited about the future merger and slight destruction of the Milky Way. So what's going to happen with the Milky Way galaxy and Andromeda?
Well, it will merge with the Andromeda galaxy and become a new, much larger galaxy. And I happen to so this is my research specialty. So I like watching galaxies go through these interactions and mergers because I think they look really cool. So the Milky Way is not really going to be destroyed so much as rebuilt into a new, bigger, much more massive galaxy at the end.
And so just for all the people that are waiting for this to happen, about how long until this this merger occurs?
About 3.5 billion years. So on the same time scale when the sun explodes.
Okay, so yeah,
we got some time.
Yeah, it'll be a billion years when the sun explodes and the merger at the same time.
Yeah.
It will be lots of things will be going on in the sky, yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask one more question from your book, from Astroquizzical. This is something I get a lot as people ask about the planets and their spins. Mm. And you say that, you know, all the planets spin the same way except for Venus and Uranus. And so what happened to those two planets? Why do all the other planets spin one way, but those two are different?
Well, the guess is that they should have all at one point been spinning the same direction. Because it makes sense. They're all moving in the same direction around the sun. The way that momentum works, they should all collapse down and spin in the same direction. So those two planets not lining up with everybody else tells us they were probably hit and tipped by some pretty massive impact early in their lifetimes. So Venus would have been hit either several times or once vigorously enough to flip it entirely over. And Uranus is just tipped over onto its side, so it's at 90 degrees to everything else. But in both cases, the suspicion is that they were struck and forcibly tipped over out of alignment with the other planets.
I'm so glad to hear that because I love explaining to kids when things run into other things. Like, that's the best, most satisfying answer that any kid could have.
Punch it really hard and it turned over.
That's right. And it's very easy to picture. So, well, Jillian, thanks so much for talking to us today. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we were talking about the phenomenon of cats in space on food. And really, Dean, what can't cats do?
Nothing. They can't do anything. They do. Well, I was going to say they can't do anything. Actually, they can't really. They don't really do very much.
They can go to space.
They can?
Yeah, actually. The French actually have sent two cats to space back in the 60s.
Whoa.
Yeah, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah, so there were cats in space. I don't know whether they were on food or not technically, but presumably they had access to some.
Yeah.
They made it. And there was a cat, Felicette, who actually made it to space and back.
Whoa, man. See, because when the Americans launched things, we launched monkeys mostly, mm-hmm. and the Russians launched dogs. Mm-hmm.
The French went with cats.
They went with cats. I think that's a good choice.
Yeah.
I mean, I was reading about, you know, why the Russians chose dogs was interesting.
Huh.
And it goes back to one of your questions that you always got at NASA is how do you go to the bathroom in space?
Uh-huh.
They picked dogs because dogs could go to the bathroom, female dogs, because they could go to the bathroom standing up, sitting down, any position. And that was one of their big considerations.
I had never thought about that.
Yeah.
But now I've got a whole new worldview.
That's right. And then I did a little digging on one of my favorite Jules Verne novels. So in their story From the Earth to the Moon, they launched humans up to the moon and around the moon and back to the Earth in a giant, cannonball, basically. Mm-hmm. They shot them off of the Earth in a giant cannon. So as your friends at NASA would do, before they send humans, you got to test it first, right?
Right, absolutely.
So they tested the cannon and they put inside the capsule, they put a cat and a squirrel.
Could go wrong.
Nothing could go wrong. So they shoot it off the Earth, goes up into the atmosphere, then falls back down to Earth. They open up the capsule. The cat is fine, safe, and everything. No sign of the squirrel.
And this is not a Schrodinger's cat. type of deal.
No, Jules Verne implies the cat ate the squirrel en route. So, cats in space with
on food. That's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks so much for Dr. Jillian Scudder for joining us. You'll find links to her and her book on our website, wvxu.org/lookingup. And you should really look up videos of snotites dripping battery acid. And thanks for letting me sit in for Anna.
Oh, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks so much, Lauren. It's been a blast. And thank you for listening. We'd love to hear from you. You can drop us a note with topic or guest ideas or questions about space on Facebook or Twitter, or email us at lookingup@wvxu.org.
Parents, thanks for encouraging an interest in space and science in your kids. And if they have any questions for us, please email us at lookingup@wvxu.org.
You can subscribe to Looking Up wherever you listen to podcasts, and give us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts. If you're new to Looking Up, you can always find all of our past episodes at wvxu.org/lookingup.
Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y question mark, from their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks for listening. I'm Lauren Worley.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.